Hello, and welcome to Responsa Radio, where you ask and we answer questions of Jewish law in modern times. I am Rabbi Avi Killip, and I am here with Rabbi Ethan Tucker, Rosh Yeshiva at Machon Hadar, a center for higher Jewish learning based in New York City.
Hello, Avi.
May a person who has been told by their doctor that they may not fast, may they lead services on Yom Kippur, is there a difference if they already knew that they could not fast when they accepted the role versus someone who discovered the fact that they couldn't fast afterwards? And then what if they lead an evening service having not yet eaten but are planning to eat later? And is there any difference if this is a woman who is pregnant versus a person with some kind of illness?
There's a lot in that question.
There's a lot there.
All right. Well, let's talk first generally about leading on a fast day when you're not fasting. And then we can head into Yom Kippur and some of these different questions. And just as sort of a frame overall here, I think there's two issues that for me, when I think about this, come to the fore. One is an issue of truth. That is to say, is the person going to be saying or articulate anything that is false as a prayer leader by dint of not fasting? And then there's an issue of representation. Can they somehow be the representative and the emissary as a non-faster of people who are fasting? And those don't necessarily cut in exactly the same way. So let's kind of get the basic building blocks on this. There is stuff that is different on fast days. Let's go outside of Yom Kippur for a minute now. Just think about fast days like the 17th of Tammuz and Tisha B'Av and, you know, Tzom Gedalia and the 10th of Tevet, like days like that. There are things that are actually different in the davening. Already in the Talmud, it's reported that, oh, you're supposed to add in special stuff for them at each of the prayers in the day. It actually says explicitly the evening prayer and the morning prayer and the afternoon prayer. And it seems that that is probably something like what we have today in our Sidurim, which is the Anenu paragraph, which is this paragraph where we say, God, answer us, B'yom Tzom Ta'anitenu, on this fast day when we are refraining from eating. Now, Rashi, on that Talmudic passage, reports a Gaonic tradition, so from the post-Talmudic period, that actually restricts this Talmudic statement, which said, oh, you add in these special paragraphs in the evening and in the morning and in the afternoon, and says, no, actually, you don't say them in the evening and the morning. Why? Because the person might not complete the fast. And so if they start saying, oh, answer me on this fast day, and then the next day they break the fast, it's completely false. And we only let them say it at Mincha because we're confident that if they made it fasting to Mincha, they're probably going to make it till the end of the day. And at that point, we don't worry about it.
That's so interesting. It's the whole concept of making a decision about an action now based on what may or may not happen in the future.
Yeah, it's very unusual in that way. And actually, a kind of compromise ends up emerging, which is we have the leader on fast days actually say that Anenu paragraph in the public Amida in the morning. But we only have the individuals say it at Mincha, and the leader also says it at the Mincha, the afternoon prayer. So there's some degree of hedging of like, hey, it's a fast day. Don't we have to be saying something publicly?
And that compromise sounds like it's hinged on the idea that we have extra faith in the fasting ability of the leader.
So that may well be right. And this takes us directly to that question of, how do we think about the leader? Because what that little discussion seems to reveal is we do indeed care that the person who says this Anenu paragraph is fasting. Even if we suspect they won't be fasting, we don't want them to say it. But certainly it would seem if they're not fasting, they can't say that.
Right. So step one is, does it even matter if they're fasting? And the answer is yes, it does.
It seems to be. However, it gets more complicated. Rav Yehudai Gaon, who is one of the figures in the Gaonic period, when you go back and actually look at what he says, so he clarifies, yeah, a leader who's not fasting can't be a leader because he can't say Anenu. So let's say you have someone who's normally their job to lead the community in prayer. You've got to take them out that day if it turns out for some reason they're not fasting, because how can they say on our fast day B'yom Tzom Ta'anitenu? The Tur, Rav Yaakov Bar Asher, considers this ruling and rejects it, and he says, I don't understand, that person could just get up and say answer us on this fast day. Sure, he can't say it in some first-person plural form, but who says that's the necessary form of the prayer? And certainly, even for someone who's not fasting but's davening in a community of fasters, they can refer to it objectively as a fast day.
Wow, that would be pretty dramatic, I think, if it happened.
Right, so it would single a person out. It would not be a good idea if it was not common knowledge that the person was fasting. But there is some notion there that, yeah, you know, at the end of the day, you're representing a community. You can sort of acknowledge this community is doing something and I'm doing it on their behalf, even if I'm not 100% fully into it. So even the tour agrees, definitely you should ideally have someone who's fasting lead. But he clearly entertains the idea that if for some other reason there's no one as qualified, certainly if there's no one else who can do it effectively, you wouldn't knock that person out of leading and have the community be much worse off because of this concern about how to say the words.
And on a philosophical level, that opens up the possibility or the acknowledgement of the reality that a leader may not always have the same experiences of the person that they are davening with and for, which seems especially striking on Yom Kippur when we do a lot of first person plural praying of things that we may not think of ourselves.
That said, the Shulchan Aruch kind of backs off that, the reading of Rav Yehudai Gaon, and basically says, you're not fasting, you can't lead on a fast day, and just leaves it at that. Now, later interpreters try to walk that back and essentially say, well, yeah, that's true for when picking someone. You definitely shouldn't pick someone, but they try to suggest that even the Shulchan Aruch would agree. Let's say someone began leading Mincha, and then it was clear once they're already standing up there that they're not fasting, and they realize it. Do they at that point like stop praying the Amidah? Do they interrupt what's happening? And the Magen Avraham wants to say, No. For sure, in that case, even the Shulchan Aruch would agree, you kind of rely on the tour's approach and you would just change the language. And that, I think, begins to open up a whole set of questions of what does it mean that someone has already started davening? Right? I would say, from someone who did these kinds of gigs for many, many years, when a synagogue has signed you up in April to lead the High Holidays that year, you have already started davening, right? Like you are locked into that arrangement. It's going to cause all kinds of havoc at that point to dump that community, them to dump you, without even getting into another factor, which none of these sources are engaging, which is some of the financial issues that come up with someone who's committed to do something and they're, for better or for worse, relying on some of the income that comes in from that. It's a much more extreme thing to say that person has to quit and drop out of that commitment, as opposed to I'm looking around the room and saying, hey, can you daven mincha? Can you daven mincha? And then, okay, I'm going to prefer someone who's fasting.
Right. And the most extreme case of that would probably be a cantor or a paid year-round leader in a synagogue.
That's right. And so when we get to the Yom Kippur piece, that'll be a particularly aggravating factor because there is this basic element of that is their job, right? Like the cantor's entire job on some level is to lead Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, if not anything else, in a way that, yeah, the 17th of Tammuz, I think you can find a backup. All right, so let's turn now to Yom Kippur, because Yom Kippur is actually interesting in this way, in that it's different from the other fast days. The other fast days, particularly the ones like Shiva Asar B'Tammuz and the non-Tisha B'Av ones, are not really days on the calendar other than being fast days. That is to say, if you are not fasting on the 17th of Tammuz, you are not observing the 17th of Tammuz. Yom Kippur is completely different. It is a day where people who don't fast are expected not to do all kinds of things that have nothing to do with fasting. You are lighting candles. And actually, one of the things that's striking about the Yom Kippur liturgy, if you pay close attention to it, is it actually almost never talks about fasting. You are fasting in the background, but the actual paragraphs of the rabbinic text, other than, you know, poems that refer to it, and sure, the term Yom Tzom Kippur comes up in prayers like Unetane Tokef, but in the actual description of what's going on, it's a day of atonement, it's a day of refraining from forbidden labor, etc., etc., it is sort of actually optically neutral on some level with respect to fasting in a way that this Anenu prayer is not.
And on an even more abstract level, existentially, theologically, something is happening on that day for you, even if you are not fasting.
That's correct. And this notion, even very powerfully captured in the rabbinic idiom, Itzumo shel yom mechaper. A power of Yom Kippur is that there's something about the day itself which atones. The fasting is this very central ritual, but it's not as if the fasting is itself the body of the spiritual cleanse, as it were, where by fasting my sins are erased. It's the fasting puts me in a mindset of repentance such that the day can be effective to do that. But the day actually has a power to do that on its own, right? No one ever suggested that a person who doesn't fast on Yom Kippur for legitimate reasons doesn't experience full atonement from God on that day.
Thank God.
Thank God. This comes up in a very technical sense where Rabbi Akiva Eger is asked whether someone who is not fasting on Yom Kippur on doctor's orders can have an aliyah in the morning in shul. And Rabbi Akiva Eger says, in the morning, of course you can give it to them. No question. Because it is a day when you would have to read Torah anyway. Like just on Shabbat morning, you read 7 aliyot. On Yom Kippur, because it's a sacred day, you're reading 6 aliyot. So you hear me say in the morning, he says, but I'm less sure about the afternoon. In the afternoon, when people are reading Torah, is it like Shabbat afternoon when we read Torah just because it's a holy day? Or is it like the other time we read Torah reading in the afternoon, which is a fast day, which you only read Torah in the afternoon because people are fasting? And like if you had 10 Jews who weren't fasting on Shiva Asar B'Tammuz and they gathered for Mincha, they wouldn't read Torah. So I think he doesn't take up the question of leading, but a simple extrapolation of his analysis would lead to saying that actually whether you're fasting or not is irrelevant in terms of this set of concerns to whether you can lead. Because everyone, whether or not they're fasting, is required to pray all 5 of those tefillot on Yom Kippur. Everyone is fully obligated in those. Yeah, there's this other obligation of fasting, which this person may be exempt from, but actually vis-a-vis these concerns of is it false, or are they sort of unable to actually discharge that obligation, that would seem to be a pretty straight up answer of not fasting on Yom Kippur is not a disability to leading the davening. Now that said, to go back to my initial piece where I said there's issues of truth, I think the truth issue is not impacted here at all. But the representation issue might be a little more complicated. And this goes to a sort of grayer area of who's fit to lead on Yom Kippur at all. You have these really interesting statements in the Shulchan Aruch that a person under the age of 30 shouldn't be leading davening on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur when at all possible, because you want someone who essentially has experienced enough of life to have had enough pain that they can actually represent and communicate with the congregation.
It's like they have to have some regrets.
Yeah, they've got to have an understanding of what it is to be imperfect and not feel invincible. And I can imagine, again, a community, and I think this would be my preference, when picking from the outset who should lead, not to just, you know, flip a coin between someone who has a medical exemption and doesn't fast and eats on Yom Kippur and someone who makes sure they don't eat on Yom Kippur, but to prefer the person who doesn't eat, because there's an aspect where they will be tapped into that element of the communal drama that this other person will not.
Is there any halachic language around the value of they're a beautiful davener? Like they do a beautiful dab and they're going to make a really spiritual experience for our community?
So yeah, actually the tour, that position that we talked about that was like, it's not such a big deal if the non-faster leads, actually says, well, sure, it's better to have someone who's fasting lead if it's possible that the leader who is fasting will be better than someone else.
Right. So that makes me think of the philosophical implications of Yom Kippur in particular, which is a holiday where we find ourselves saying a lot of things in the first person plural, even if they don't necessarily apply to us as an individual because of the power of the day and the communal experience of it.
Yeah, it's great. So that's particularly powerful because there's actually another view which on some level short circuits our whole conversation here, where the Aruch HaShulchan says, no, you misunderstood the whole discussion in the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch, when he said, if you're not fasting, you don't lead, only meant that about an optional fast day, where 10 people come together and for something that they want to fast for are entitled, we know, to have actually a full service with Torah reading and all of that if they want to establish that. And that's why, says the Aruch HaShulchan, there was nervousness about a fast day that's only being created because a bunch of people are fasting. How could you put someone up as a leader who's not fasting? But says the Aruch HaShulchan, when you're dealing with a public fast day that's on the calendar, like the 17th of Tammuz, of course you can say Yom Tzom Ta'aniteinu, our fast day, because it's the Jewish community's fast day.
So let's see if we can quickly go through some of these follow-up questions. The first follow-up question we touched on a little bit was, can they lead Arvid if they've not yet eaten but are planning to eat later?
As we saw, when the ritual is about fasting, then it's potentially a problem to do that. But in this context of Yom Kippur, part of what I'm arguing, based on that Rabbi Akiva Eger and the Aruch HaShulchan, is actually that issue doesn't come up on Yom Kippur at all. And so therefore, the question of the fasting is simply really irrelevant for the purposes of determining whether that person can lead davening, assuming, right, this is the one caveat, assuming the person has some warranted exemption from the fast. It is a whole other level of problematic to allow someone to lead davening who says, yeah, I just don't fast on Yom Kippur. It's not meaningful to me. But I get a lot of meaning out of leading Shacharit. That's not someone I would feel comfortable assigning to davening in that way.
Okay, so then let's address this last question, which is, would there be any difference of a woman leading who is pregnant and maybe eating because she's pregnant as opposed to someone who has an illness?
Yeah, so here's, I think you can imagine, I don't have millennia of precedent, so I'm going to give you my take on it, but I think time is going to see sort of how it plays out. You know, I feel two impulses here, and I'm interested to hear kind of how you would think about it. On the one hand, there's a part of me that feels that, well, you know, pregnancy is a very kind of temporary condition by definition. And there's a sense in which perhaps the right response is to say, maybe even more so than with someone who has a condition, let's say like diabetes, where they're not going to be able to fast for their entire life, that actually, you know, the years where a woman who is serving as a prayer leader is pregnant, maybe those are years where she takes a sort of step out of that rotation and doesn't, you know, sign up for it that year and is aware of it. And with all the usual caveats that we engaged with before, you're far enough in the process, the shul's signed you up, you don't know. But that is
the cantor.
Yeah, okay, so we'll get to the cantor in a second because that's what pulls me the other direction. But that when you're just asking the question, let's say there's an independent minion that's like, hey, who should we ask to lead davening this year? You know, from our stock of daveners, you might say, well, okay, you know, such and such is pregnant this year. We'll give her off this year. We'll come back to her next year and put this person in the rotation. There is something about that that makes sense to me. I think where I'm pulled the other direction is by two factors. One, you talk about the cantor and you talk about certain kind of steady arrangements of being in this position and the implication of having a kind of policy or approach I just had would be to, you know, knock out a significant number of women at a key phase of being a kind of reliable go-to person to fulfill that kind of role. You know, someone who's expecting in September and October, that may happen anyway, but you have a kind of more dramatic impact there. That's one piece. The other piece is, I'm not sure pregnancy and illness should be thought about in the same way. And that illness is something we can all honestly say we genuinely wish neither we nor anyone else suffered from. Pregnancy, for the continuation of the human race and the Jewish people is a positive state of being that we want and hope will be a mainstay in the communities in which we live. And it's not that, you know, therefore there aren't some meaningful parallels that are very appropriate between being in a kind of state of illness and having your body compromised and being pregnant in terms of leniencies that are afforded. But there is something about sort of treating someone who is not fasting because they're pregnant as being in a sort of non-ideal mode of fully representing the community that rubs me in the wrong way from that angle. And here's maybe the one creative thing I would potentially say. I'm not sure even that that early Gaonic opposition to people who are not fasting, leading, is even clearly about, when you look at the sources, someone who has an authorized exemption not to fast, as opposed to someone who's just not fasting. And someone who is pregnant in a kind of very obvious, optically clear way in most cases, is quite obviously in a position of, you know, a potentially different situation with respect to the fast. Here's where it's complicated. All right, and here's where I really am interested what you think. The problem is, of course, let's remember, pregnant women are obligated to fast on Yom Kippur. They don't have an exemption. It just may be that in any number of cases, a given woman who's pregnant might be told, you have doctor's orders that you need to eat. The tricky case, I'm not sure I have a clear answer to this, is what is truly the case for most pregnant women is, whatever possible chance they might have had of making it through Yom Kippur successfully fasting or eating and drinking in small amounts would be significantly compromised, if not eliminated, by having them take on a job of leading. And what that means is, what you're really asking is it permitted to engage in an elective activity, maybe a mitzvah-related activity for a community, but nonetheless one that you're planning that will end up having the effect of making you need to break Yom Kippur?
Yeah, I think that comes up even not in terms of leading, but just in terms of going to shul, that there are many pregnant women who ask themselves, is it better to stay at home and fast or to walk a mile, you know, or even less than a mile, maybe to get to shul, which could cause them to have a much harder time. And I think in terms of your framing of the pregnancy not being in the exemption, that also is a helpful way to think about the distinction between pregnancy not being an illness, but pregnancy frequently leading to the potential for illness. And I think particularly one thing that sets pregnancy apart, when we originally stated the question, the person asked, is it different if you already knew that you were going to be ill? I think a lot of times pregnant women don't know yet how they're going to feel on the particular day of davening. It's hard to know whether they'll be totally fine or whether they'll run into some kind of health problem in the moment.
Right. And I think, look, it's a very taxing thing to lead davening on Yom Kippur, even those of us who have not been pregnant and never will be pregnant. I mean, I've had some grueling situations with leading davening on Yom Kippur. One time I actually almost passed out after like leading davening for the entire day. There is some degree of everyone, and certainly pregnant women, of doing their best to kind of assess in advance, what am I reasonably going to be able to handle? This notion of eating in smaller amounts is a potentially useful tool for saying, okay, well, maybe what I can do is try my best to kind of make it through it in this fasting situation. But what I'll know I may have to fall back on, but won't be so outrageous, is to eat in these sort of smaller amounts that will maintain some sense of participating in the fast with the rest of the community. And it could be that, you know, women who do really know that actually their state in pregnancy is so fragile that really taking on anything like leading in that way is just going to actually lead them to a complete loss of any eating, drinking restrictions on Yom Kippur. It might be that that subset of people is not the right set of people to do that job, and there's other ways that they can and should contribute.
Right, but it's important for us to clarify that's a decision that affects them personally and their personal observance, and it's not going to affect or change their community's responsibility to find a reasonable davener.
That is correct. Their davening would still be 100% valid no matter what they did. That really goes back to the more difficult issues that you raised of how does someone who doesn't know exactly how they're going to feel in those situations, how much do they cut themselves off from things they would otherwise normally do?
What's the responsibility of the davener to tell the community that they are not fasting? I think it comes up with pregnancy. You described pregnancy as something that's obvious to everyone, but at the beginning of pregnancy, when in fact it's sometimes the hardest not to go without eating because of nausea or morning sickness, is people are frequently not ready to tell the community that they're not fasting or that they're pregnant. And I think a lot of times with illness also, it's something that people deal with privately. They may not want everyone to know that they're have whatever the condition is.
That's a very tough question. I feel like we could do a whole other episode on the issues of what kind of disclosure does a person need to give a community about what they're doing. For this purposes, the way it would feel to me is you're not fundamentally compromising the tefillah of the community in terms of what you're doing by leading it, in the sense of, you know, what we've talked about, the fasting, not fasting on Yom Kippur isn't really relevant to your core obligation in tefillah. You should feel good for your own internal reasons, but I would say it does have ramifications for the community about being legitimated and having a legitimate exemption or practice of what you're going to do on Yom Kippur. And if you feel like you just have some idiosyncratic decision that you've made about what you think is okay, but the community wouldn't approve of that, that's probably something you need to share. But I don't think every diabetic who needs to eat on Yom Kippur needs to tell their community, actually, I'm a diabetic, so I eat. But I also think, and I've heard some bad stories about this, you have to be extremely private and concealed about your eating in those circumstances. Like, you don't show up to your hosts, you know, on Yom Kippur morning as a visiting rabbi from out of town and say, can you tell me where the cereal is? Because actually I eat. Like, you got to pack yourself some secret food that you stash away and no one should know about it. Not in the sense that it's sort of something to hide or be ashamed of, but particularly when you're visiting in a community like that, there's something about giving people a sense of, you know, I'm with you in this, that you have to be very careful and sensitive to not breaking down. So I think the key thing is you have to feel like you've gone through enough of a process with integrity of, I feel like I'm doing the right thing in terms of my religious obligations. Once you do that, as long as you are very discreet and private about it, I don't think there's a disclosure requirement beyond that. But it's a really great question.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I think it also has implications and lessons for those of us who are not leading in how we behave in the congregation also. Thanks.
Thank you.
Responsa Radio is a project for the Center for Jewish Law and Values at Machon Hadar and is produced by Jewish Public Media, which creates, curates, and promotes excellent Jewish content. If you have a halachic question you'd like answered on the show, email us at halacha@machonhadar.org. You can also leave us a voicemail at 215-297-4254.